I didn't know it was a gun until later, she told me. She got up sleepily to look around and found her mother standing just inside the open front door of the house, weeping and wringing her hands. The March air was rushing in. You know, it's the weirdest thing. I can still close my eyes and see her standing there like that. The wind was blowing her bathrobe around, and it was like I knew everything, everything that happened, right at that moment before I even knew anything. I knew what had happened. I knew my father would be arrested. I saw it all. Well, that's like a picture from a nightmare, right? The whole thing was like a nightmare. You can't believe it's happening in real life, and you keep thinking you'll wake up. Sometimes I still think I'm just going to wake up, and everything was just some kind of horrible dream. But how did I know everything before I even knew anything? I saw my mom standing there like it was happening in the past, like deja vu or something. It was weird. Or maybe not. Maybe it just seems that way now when I remember it. I don't know. As soon as she saw Hannah, her mother grabbed her as if pulling her daughter out of the way of an oncoming train and screamed at her, "Don't go out there. Don't go out there." Hannah made no move toward the outside, nor did she press her mother for an explanation. She just stood there in her terrified mother's embrace. "I'd never seen her like that before," Hannah said. "Still, like I keep wanting to say, it was almost as if I'd been through it already. I knew I'd better stay inside." At some point, Hannah is not sure how long this took, her father came in by the wide-open front door to the place where she and her mother stood clutching each other. He didn't have the gun in his hand. He dropped it out there in the yard somewhere. Wearing only pajama pants, he stood before his little family. He looked fine. He was sort of panting, but, I mean, he didn't look frightened or anything. And for just a second, just about half a second, I thought maybe everything was going to be okay. As she told me this, Hannah's tears came again. But I was too scared to ask him what happened. After a while, Mom let go of me. She went and she called the police. I remember she asked him, "Is he hurt?" And he said, "I think so. I think I hurt him really bad." And then she went into the kitchen and she called the police. "That's what you're supposed to do, right?" "Right," I said. It had not been a rhetorical question. In bits and pieces, Hannah learned what had happened. Earlier, during that awful night, Hannah's mother, always a light sleeper, had heard noises coming from the living room, sounds like breaking glass, and had roused her sleeping husband. There were more noises. The man of the house became convinced there was an intruder to be dealt with and got out of bed to prepare. Carefully, according to his wife later, by only the dim illumination of a tiny book light, he took out the gun box that he kept in the bedroom closet, unlocked it, and loaded the gun. His wife pleaded with him simply to call the police. He never even replied to this entreaty. He hissed at her commandingly, "Stay here." And still in near darkness, he left for the living room. Seeing him, or more likely hearing him, the prowler fled the house by the front door. Hannah's father gave chase, shot at the man, and by sheer blind luck, as one of his attorneys would put it later, hit him in the back of the head, killing him instantly. As it happened, the intruder fell on the sidewalk between the lawn and the curb. This meant, technically, that Hannah's father had shot an unarmed man on the street. Strangely, incredibly, no neighbors came out of their houses. "Everything was so quiet after, so very, very quiet," Hannah said to me there in my office. The police arrived quickly after Hannah's mother called them, followed by a few more people and a silent ambulance. Eventually, her father and her mother were taken away to the police station. My mother called her sister and my uncle to come stay with me for the rest of the night, just like I was suddenly a little girl all over again. They weren't any help. They were pretty hysterical. I think I just felt really numb. The next day, and in the following weeks, the situation occupied the local media's interest. The shooting had taken place in a quiet, middle-class suburb. The shooter was an ordinary, middle-class man with no known history of violence. He had not been drunk, nor had he been using drugs. The dead man was a known felon, a drug addict, and just before he was shot, he had broken into the house through a window. No one except the prosecuting attorney disputed that he was a robber, or that Hannah's father had pursued and shot him because he had been an intruder in the house. This was a victim's rights case. This was a gun control case. This was a get-tough-on-crime case. It clearly illustrated the dangers of being a vigilante. Or maybe it demonstrated conclusively that homeowners ought to have increased rights. The ACLU got mad. The NRA, even more so. There was a long trial, as Hannah had said, and then an appeal and another long trial. In the end, Hannah's father was convicted of voluntary manslaughter and sentenced to a maximum of 10 years in prison. The attorneys said it was more likely to be only 2 or 3. The news of a high school principal sentenced to 10 years in prison for shooting a burglar on his front lawn aroused strong emotions. There were protests on all sides. The decision was unconstitutional. It defied common sense and natural law. The convicted man was a dangerous self-appointee and a rights violator. He was an American hero and a family protector. He was a violent madman. He was a martyr to the cause, to any number of causes. Through all of this, impossibly, Hannah was going to college, making A's, and applying to medical schools, activities dogmatically insisted upon by her embattled father. "He just wouldn't allow my life to be ruined by all this stupidity," that's what he said. And Hannah got into nearly every medical school she applied to, despite her father's predicament. She told me that, if anything, the whole thing probably helped me get in. He was a cause. Finished with her narrative, Hannah searched through a small leather handbag, found a tissue, and began to blot her cheeks and dab at the streaks on her shirt. This she did even though there was a full box of tissues in plain sight on the little table just at her left elbow. "So, you see, I don't really need therapy exactly, but I really would like to talk to someone. I really don't want to be this depressed when I start med school. I don't know. Do you think it would be all right for me to see you?" Hannah had affected me with her story and with her demeanor. I felt tremendous sympathy for her, and I told her so. To myself, I wondered how much help she would actually be able to accept from me, the psychological trauma therapist she had called because she had seen my name in a newspaper article. Out loud, we agreed to meet once a week for a while, so Hannah could have someone to talk to. The medical school she had finally chosen was in Boston, and at her mother's urging, she had moved east right after her college graduation, so she could be settled in before classes started and away from the craziness back home. Her mother felt the situation with her husband was negative for her daughter. I thought I had seldom heard such an understatement, and I assured Hannah that, yes, it would be all right for her to see me. After she left, I paced around my office for a minute or two, staring out the tall windows onto Boston's Back Bay, walking over to riffle papers on the wide, cluttered desk, and then returning to the window, as I often do after a session in which someone has told me a great deal, but not nearly everything. As I paced, I was interested not so much in the legal and political questions of who, what, when, and where, but rather in psychology's perennial question of why. Hannah had not asked why, as in, why did my father shoot that gun? Why didn't he just let the man go? I reflected that emotionally, she could not afford to ask why, as the answer might be too unsettling. The entire relationship with her father was at stake, and maybe this was the reason she needed me, to help her navigate through the conceivable answers to this perilous question. Perhaps her father had been caught up in the frenzy of the moment and had shot the gun almost accidentally, hitting the intruder lethally in the head by sheer blind luck, as the attorney had said. Or perhaps her father had genuinely believed his family was in danger and his protective instincts had taken him over. Or perhaps Hannah's father, the family man, this ordinary middle-class high school principal, was a killer. In subsequent sessions, during that summer and in the fall as Hannah began medical school, she told me more about her father. In the kind of work I do, I often hear about behaviors and events that the patient herself, over her lifetime, has grown used to and thinks of as normal, but that to me sound distinctly abnormal and sometimes alarming. This kind of report is what I soon began to get from Hannah. As she described her father, though she obviously believed she was recounting unremarkable stories, I pieced together the picture of an emotionally cold individual whose mean and controlling actions made me cringe. Also, I became familiar with the understandable haze my intelligent young patient was lost in when it came to seeing her father for what he was. I discovered that Hannah's father dealt with his pretty wife and his high-achieving daughter more like trophies than human beings, usually ignoring them completely when they were sick or having a difficult time for some other reason. But lovingly, Hannah reinterpreted her father's callous treatment of her. "He's really proud of me," she said, "or so I've always thought, and so he can't stand it when I make mistakes. Once when I was in the fourth grade, my teacher sent a note home that I wasn't doing my homework. Dad didn't speak to me for 2 weeks after that. I know it was 2 weeks because I had this little calendar. I still have it somewhere, and I marked off the days one by one. It was as if suddenly I didn't even exist. It was awful. Oh, and another good example, more recent, I was in high school already, his high school, you know, and I got this really huge, ugly blemish on my cheek." She pointed to an empty space on her lovely complexion. "He didn't say a word to me, wouldn't even look at me, for 3 days. He's such a perfectionist. I guess he wants to show me off, and when something's wrong, he really can't do that. It makes me feel bad about myself sometimes, but I suppose I can understand it, more or less." Hannah described a time in her childhood when her mother had been critically ill and in the hospital for nearly 3 weeks. Hannah believed her mother had contracted pneumonia, but she said, "I was really too young to remember much about it." Hannah's aunt had taken her to see her mother during this time. But her father had not visited his wife once while she was hospitalized, and when she returned home, he was angry and agitated, concerned that his pale and weakened wife might not get her beauty back, as Hannah phrased it. "As for Hannah's pretty mother, there really isn't much to tell," Hannah told me. "She's sweet and gentle. She always took care of me, especially when I was little. She likes to garden, and she does a lot of charities and such. She's just a really nice lady. Oh, and she was the homecoming queen when she was in high school. Dad likes to tell people that." When I pressed Hannah about her mother's reaction to her father's neglectful behavior, she said, "I don't know. I mean, to be honest, there were things that would have made me really angry if I'd been Mom, but she never said anything. She just kind of goes her own way. Like I said, she's a sweet, gentle lady. That's probably what you'd hear if you asked someone who knows her. And I guess what goes along with that is she never really stands up for herself very much. She certainly never confronts Dad. I mean, I think I'd faint dead away if she ever did that. She's the perfect lady. Her only little flaw, if you could even call it that, is her vanity. She's really beautiful, and I think she knows it. And she spends a lot of time working on her hair and her body and such. I think she sees that as her only power in the world, if that makes any sense." Hannah looked at me questioningly, and I nodded that I understood what she meant. "And to give him his due, Dad's really good to her about that. He sends her flowers when he's gone, and he always tells her how beautiful she is. I think that kind of thing must really mean a lot to her." "He sends her flowers when he's gone?" I asked. "Where does he go?" When I asked that question, "Where does he go?" Hannah's composure lost a little ground. She shifted in her chair and said nothing for a moment. Finally, she replied, "I don't really know. I know that must sound sort of lame, but I don't. Sometimes he'd come in really late at night, or he'd even be gone for a whole weekend. Mom would get flowers. I mean, really, it was between the two of them. It was just too weird, so I tried to ignore it." "His absences were weird?" "Yes, well, that's the way I felt. I don't know how Mom feels about it." "Any guesses about where he went?" I pressed her, probably a little too hard, but it seemed an important point. "No, I always tried to ignore it," she repeated. Then she began to study my bookshelves again. The next week, I asked Hannah the conspicuous question of whether her father had ever been physically violent with her or her mother. Had he ever hit them? She brightened and answered eagerly, "Oh, no, he's never done anything like that. I can't even imagine it. In fact, if anyone else ever hurt me or Mom, I think he'd kill them." I waited an instant for the impact of her words to strike her, but she appeared unaffected. She shifted her position again and reinforced her answer, saying, "No, he never hit us. Nothing like that ever went on at all." She was unaccountably pleased to answer me in this way, and somehow I was inclined to believe her, that her father had never been physically violent in the context of his family. But after 25 years of treating trauma survivors, I have learned that getting hit is actually one of the more bearable ways a person can be assaulted. I tried a different tack. I said, I know you loved your father, and you need to hold on tight to that love right now, but all relationships have their difficulties. There's nothing about him that you'd change if you could? Yes, that's absolutely right. I do need to hold on to him, and he really deserves to have huge sympathy from everyone, especially now. She paused and craned her neck to look behind her at the double doors to my office. Then she turned back and looked at me for a long moment, as if appraising my motives, and finally said, But since you want to know what I'd change, there is something, actually. She made a little humorless laugh and blushed scarlet to the roots of her shimmering black hair. What's that? I asked, matter-of-factly as I could. It's a silly thing, really. It's, well, sometimes he flirts with my friends, sort of, and it really bothers me. Actually, now that I say it out loud, it sounds even more ridiculous. I guess it shouldn't bother me so much, but it really does. He flirts with your friends? How do you mean? Since junior high school, more or less, some of my friends are really gorgeous, you know. There's this one in particular named Georgia. Well, anyway, he flirts with them. He winks at them and kind of grabs them and tickles them. And sometimes he makes what I think are really suggestive remarks. Like, he'll say, Going braless today, Georgia? Or something. But I guess I'm misinterpreting. Oh, man. Now that I'm talking about this out loud, it's like uber dumb, don't you think? It probably shouldn't bother me at all. I said, If I were in your place, I think it would bother me a lot. You do? She looked encouraged for a moment and then sagged. You know, at the high school Dad runs, the high school I went to, parents have actually claimed he was inappropriate with their kids. There were three times, I think, or at least those are the ones that I heard about. I remember one time the parents were really steamed. They actually took their kid out of the school. Everyone came to his rescue after that. They thought it was really sad these days that such a good, kind man could be accused of some perverse thing just because he gave one of his students a hug or whatever. And what do you think? I don't know. I'll probably burn in hell or something for admitting this. But the truth is that I don't know. I guess because I've seen him do so much stuff that people could misread really easily, you know? I mean, if you're the principal and you walk up behind some hot-looking 16-year-old in the hall and you grab her by the waist, you've got to expect her parents to get a little ticked if they hear about it. I don't know why he doesn't understand that. This time, Hannah did not ask me to confirm her opinion. She stared at the bookshelf some more and was silent. Finally, in a little flood of rushed words, she said, You know what else? I've never told this to anyone, and I hope you're not going to think less of me because I'm telling you. But one time this girl I know, I didn't know her very well, but she went to the high school. She came up and sat beside me in the library and started writing notes. She was smiling, and she wrote, Do you know what your father told me about Central High? And she passed it to me. I wrote, I give up. What? And she wrote, He told me Central was like a sexual cafeteria. She put sexual cafeteria in big quotes. I was so furious I almost couldn't keep from crying, but I got out of there, and then I didn't know what to do with the piece of paper, so I crumpled it up and I put it in my pocket, and when I got home, I got matches and I burned it in the sink. The rush of words over, she looked down at the rust-colored carpet. I'm so sorry, Hannah. You truly didn't deserve to have that happen to you. You must have been so embarrassed and so heartbroken. But why did you imagine I'd think less of you for telling me? In a voice much younger than her 22 years, she answered, I should have kept it a secret. It's disloyal. Hannah and I continued our sessions together. At the beginning of many of her appointments, she would tell me about strange phone messages her mother was receiving back home. After the night of the burglary, we pretty much stopped being able to answer the phone. There were so many so-called reporters and so many cranks. At this point, Mom always just lets the machine answer, and if it's somebody she wants to talk to, she can pick up. It's okay, I guess. She just erases the cranks. But lately, she's been getting these weird druggy messages. They really upset her. They're freaky. I mean, even freakier than the usual freaks. Has she told you what they say? I asked.
Sort of. She gets so upset it's a little hard to make sense of what she's saying to me on the phone. But I think the basic idea is they're accusing Dad of dealing drugs or something. Ridiculous stuff, but it really gets to Mom. She said they were demanding to get some kind of information from the house, or they were going to hurt him. I guess they kept saying something about information and things about hurting him, but there's nothing in the house, and I mean, Dad's not there. He's in prison.
Has your mother notified the police about the messages?
No, she's afraid that she'll get Dad in trouble.
For a moment, I could not think of an appropriate reply to this last remark, and when I was silent, Hannah filled in. She said, I know, it's illogical. By the end of Hannah's first year in medical school, her mother had received a dozen or so of these incomprehensible and frightening messages, and still neither mother nor daughter had reported them to the police. In May, Hannah decided she wanted to fly out and visit her imprisoned father. We talked about how emotionally painful such a visit would be for her, but she was determined to go. We had several conversations about her upcoming trip, trying to prepare her for the various situations she might need to handle, and for the feelings she might have when she saw her father in prison. But nothing could have prepared either Hannah or me for what did happen. In retrospect, I believe he must have reached the point of wanting an audience for his gamesmanship, a frame of mind similar to Skip's when he enticed his little sister to the lakeside. I cannot think of any other likely reason that Hannah's father would suddenly have been so forthcoming with his daughter. As for Hannah, she had not told me she intended to be blunt with her father. Perhaps she did not even know this herself beforehand. To my mind, her behavior when she visited the prison is one of the best illustrations I have ever encountered of how much a person can know about another person without consciously knowing that she knows it. When she got back to Boston, this is what she told me about their conversation. I imagine that more was said, but the following is all that Hannah shared with me. She began somewhat tearfully, describing the harrowing and undignified process of getting into a prison to visit an inmate. Then her tears cleared completely, and she told me the rest calmly, with a certain intellectual detachment. She said, I was terrified he'd look pathetic and beaten, but he didn't look that way at all. He looked fine. He looked, I don't know, alive, is what I want to say. His eyes were sparkling. I've seen him like that before, but I really didn't expect to see him that way in prison. He seemed glad to see me. He asked me about my grades. I thought he'd ask me about Mom, but he didn't. And so I thought, why put it off? So I asked him. She made this statement as if I knew what she meant, and I did not. I said, you asked him what? I asked him, what was that man looking for in the house, Dad? He said, what man? But I'm sure he knew what I was talking about. He didn't look ashamed or embarrassed or any of that. I said, the man you shot. He didn't even blink. He just said, oh, that man. He was looking for some names, but he didn't find them, I can assure you of that. Hannah had been speaking without looking at me. Now she made eye contact and said, Dr. Stout, his expression. He looked like you were talking about something that was really fun to talk about. I wanted to run out of there, but I didn't. I didn't know you were going to do this. You're amazing. It was awful, she continued without seeming to hear that I was marveling at her actions. I said, so you knew him? And he said, of course I knew him. Why would I kill a perfect stranger? And then he laughed. He laughed, Dr. Stout. Still speaking directly to me, though with considerable emotional distance from the subject matter, she went on. And then I said, are you involved with heroin? He didn't really answer that one. He just told me that I was smart. Can you believe that? He told me that I was smart. She shook her head in disbelief and was silent for a while. Finally, I prompted her. I said, did you ask other questions, Hannah? Yes. Yes, I did ask him. I said, have you ever killed anyone else? And do you know what he said? Then she was silent again. After a moment, I replied, no, I don't. What did he say? He said, I plead the fifth. Only then did Hannah cry again, this time without restraint. Her sudden, wrenching grief for the father she had thought was there reminded me of a quotation from Emerson,
who said that of all the ways to lose a person, death is the kindest. She wept for a long time, but I was relieved to find that when her tears were finally spent, she was able to turn her thoughts to her own safety. Wiping her face with a handful of tissues from the box, she looked at me and said in a steady voice, "The lawyers are going to get him out, you know. What am I going to do?" And I heard myself answering with decidedly more directive maternal ferocity than I am accustomed to using in therapy sessions, "You're going to protect yourself, Hannah. What can the conscience-bound do about the guiltless?" Sociopaths are not few and far between. On the contrary, they make up a significant portion of our population. Though Hannah's experience was especially up close and personal, for any individual living in the Western world to get all the way through life without knowing at least one such person, in some capacity or other, is virtually impossible. People without conscience experience emotions very differently from you and me, and they do not experience love at all, or any other kind of positive attachment to their fellow human beings. This deficit, which is hard even to ponder, reduces life to an endless game of attempted domination over other people. Sometimes sociopaths are physically violent, as Hannah's father was. Often they are not, preferring to win over others by raiding the business world or the professions or government, or simply by exploiting one person at a time in parasitic relationships, as Sydney's non-husband Luke did. At present, sociopathy is incurable. Furthermore, sociopaths almost never wish to be cured. In fact, it is likely that, building on the neurobiological configuration of sociopathy, certain cultures, notably our Western one, actively encourage antisocial behaviors, including violence, murder, and warmongering. These facts are difficult for most people to accept. They are offensive, non-egalitarian, and frightening. But understanding and accepting them as a real aspect of our world is rule number one of the 13 rules for dealing with sociopaths in everyday life that I tell to patients like Hannah, and to other people who are interested in protecting themselves and the people they love. Here are the 13 rules. 13 rules for dealing with sociopaths in everyday life. 1. The first rule involves the bitter pill of accepting that some people literally have no conscience. These people do not often look like Charles Manson or a Ferengi bartender. They look like us. 2. In a contest between your instincts and what is implied by the role a person has taken on, educator, doctor, leader, animal lover, humanist, parent, go with your instincts. Whether you want to be or not, you are a constant observer of human behavior, and your unfiltered impressions, though alarming and seemingly outlandish, may well help you out if you will let them. Your best self understands, without being told, that impressive and moral-sounding labels do not bestow conscience on anyone who did not have it to begin with. 3. When considering a new relationship of any kind, practice the rule of threes regarding the claims and promises a person makes, and the responsibilities he or she has. Make the rule of threes your personal policy. One lie, one broken promise, or a single neglected responsibility may be a misunderstanding instead. 2 may involve a serious mistake. But 3 lies says you're dealing with a liar, and deceit is the linchpin of conscienceless behavior. Cut your losses and get out as soon as you can. Leaving, though it may be hard, will be easier now than later, and less costly. Do not give your money, your work, your secrets, or your affection to a 3-timer. Your valuable gifts will be wasted. 4. Question authority. Once again, trust your own instincts and anxieties, especially those concerning people who claim that dominating others, violence, war, or some other violation of your conscience, is the grand solution to some problem. Do this even when, or especially when, everyone around you has completely stopped questioning authority. Recite to yourself what Stanley Milgram taught us about obedience. At least 6 out of 10 people will blindly obey to the bitter end an official-looking authority in their midst. The good news is that having social support makes people somewhat more likely to challenge authority. Encourage those around you to question, too. 5. Suspect flattery. Compliments are lovely, especially when they are sincere, In contrast, flattery is extreme and appeals to our egos in unrealistic ways. It is the material of counterfeit charm and nearly always involves an intent to manipulate. Manipulation through flattery is sometimes innocuous and sometimes sinister. Peek over your massaged ego and remember to suspect flattery. This flattery rule applies on an individual basis and also on the level of groups and even whole nations. Throughout all of human history and to the present, the call to war has included the flattering claim that one's own forces are about to accomplish a victory that will change the world for the better, a triumph that is morally laudable, justified by its humane outcome, unique in human endeavor, righteous, and worthy of enormous gratitude. Since we began to record the human story, all of our major wars have been framed in this way, on all sides of the conflict. And in all languages, the adjective most often applied to the word war is holy. An argument can easily be made that humanity will have peace when nations of people are at last able to see through this masterful flattery. Just as an individual pumped up on the flattery of a manipulator is likely to behave in foolish ways, exaggerated patriotism that is flattery-fueled is a dangerous thing. 6. If necessary, redefine your concept of respect. Too often we mistake fear for respect, and the more fearful we are of someone, the more we view him or her as deserving of our respect. I have a spotted Bengal cat who was named Muscle Man by my daughter when she was a toddler, because even as a kitten he looked like a professional wrestler. Grown now, he is much larger than most other domestic cats. His formidable claws resemble those of his Asian leopard cat ancestors, but by temperament he is gentle and peace-loving. My neighbor has a little calico who visits. Evidently, the calico's predatory charisma is huge, and she is brilliant at directing the evil eye at other cats. Whenever she is within 50 feet, Muscle Man, all 15 pounds of him to her 7, cringes and crouches in fear and feline deference. Muscle Man is a splendid cat. He is warm and loving, and he is close to my heart. Nonetheless, I would like to believe that some of his reactions are more primitive than mine. I hope I do not mistake fear for respect, because to do so would be to ensure my own victimization. Let us use our big human brains to overpower our animal tendency to bow to predators, so we can disentangle the reflexive confusion of anxiety and awe. In a perfect world, human respect would be an automatic reaction only to those who are strong, kind, and morally courageous. The person who profits from frightening you is not likely to be any of these. The resolve to keep respect separate from fear is even more crucial for groups and nations. The politician, small or lofty, who menaces the people with frequent reminders of the possibility of crime, violence, or terrorism, and who then uses their magnified fear to gain allegiance, is more likely to be a successful con artist than a legitimate leader. This, too, has been true throughout human history. 7. Do not join the game. Intrigue is a sociopath's tool. Resist the temptation to compete with a seductive sociopath, to outsmart him, psychoanalyze, or even banter with him. In addition to reducing yourself to his level, you would be distracting yourself from what is really important, which is to protect yourself. 8. The best way to protect yourself from a sociopath is to avoid him, to refuse any kind of contact or communication. Psychologists do not usually like to recommend avoidance, but in this case I make a very deliberate exception. The only truly effective method for dealing with a sociopath you have identified is to disallow him or her from your life altogether. Sociopaths live completely outside of the social contract, and therefore to include them in relationships or other social arrangements is perilous. Begin this exclusion of them in the context of your own relationships and social life. You will not hurt anyone's feelings. Strange as it seems, and though they may try to pretend otherwise, sociopaths do not have any such feelings to hurt. You may never be able to make your family and friends understand why you are avoiding a particular individual. Sociopathy is surprisingly difficult to see, and even harder to explain. Avoid him anyway. If total avoidance is impossible, make plans to come as close as you can to the goal of total avoidance. 9. Question your tendency to pity too easily. Respect should be reserved for the kind and the morally courageous. Pity is another socially valuable response, and it should be reserved for innocent people who are in genuine pain or who have fallen on misfortune. If instead you find yourself often pitying someone who consistently hurts you or other people and who actively campaigns for your sympathy, the chances are close to 100% that you are dealing with a sociopath. Related to this, I recommend that you severely challenge your need to be polite in absolutely all situations. For normal adults in our culture, being what we think of as civilized is like a reflex, and often we find ourselves being automatically decorous, even when someone has enraged us, repeatedly lied to us, or figuratively stabbed us in the back. Sociopaths take huge advantage of this automatic courtesy in exploitive situations. Do not be afraid to be unsmiling and calmly to the point. 10. Do not try to redeem the unredeemable. Second, third, fourth, and fifth chances are for people who possess conscience. If you are dealing with a person who has no conscience, know how to swallow hard and cut your losses. At some point, most of us need to learn the important, if disappointing, life lesson that no matter how good our intentions, we cannot control the behavior, let alone the character structures of other people. Learn this fact of human life and avoid the irony of getting caught up in the same ambition he has, to control. If you do not desire control, but instead want to help people, then help only those who truly want to be helped. I think you will find this does not include the person who has no conscience. The sociopath's behavior is not your fault, not in any way whatsoever. It is also not your mission. Your mission is your own life. 11. Never agree, out of pity or for any other reason, to help a sociopath conceal his or her true character. Please don't tell. Often spoken tearfully and with great gnashing of teeth, is the trademark plea of thieves, child abusers, and sociopaths. Do not listen to this siren song. Other people deserve to be warned more than sociopaths deserve to have you keep their secrets. If someone without conscience insists that you owe him or her, recall what you are about to read here. "You owe me" has been the standard line of sociopaths for thousands of years, quite literally, and is still so. It is what Rasputin told the Empress of Russia. It is what Hannah's father implied to her after the eye-opening conversation with him at the prison. We tend to experience "you owe me" as a compelling claim, but it is simply not true. Do not listen. Also, ignore the one that goes, "you are just like me." You are not. 12. Defend your psyche. Do not allow someone without conscience, or even a string of such people, to convince you that humanity is a failure. Most human beings do possess conscience. Most human beings are able to love. 13. Living well is the best revenge. Epilogue. I still meet with Hannah occasionally. Her father was paroled from prison, but she has not seen him or even spoken with him in the last 6 years. This loss, and the reasons for it, remain a source of tremendous sadness for her. Her mother and father are now divorced, due not to his violent criminal activities, which Hannah's mother and the rest of society still refuse to acknowledge, but to the fact that she found him in bed with a 19-year-old former student. In testimony to her intelligence and her strength, Hannah finished medical school with honors, but she soon discovered the obvious, that being a doctor had been her father's ambition for her, not her own. He had considered this to be the height of prestige. Against the odds, Hannah has held on to her ability to feel close to people who are loving and trustworthy, and also on to a dry sense of humor. When she left medicine, for example, she told me she had realized that the medical oath, "first, do no harm," simply did not fit her father at all. She applied to and was accepted by several law schools. She chose to attend one that offers a specialization in advocacy and human rights. Chapter 9. The Origins of Conscience. Why should any animal off on its own, specified and labeled by all sorts of signals as its individual self, choose to give up its life in aid of someone else? Lewis Thompson. Since we have it on excellent authority that nature is red in tooth and claw, why are all human beings not killers like Hannah's father? Why do most of us, most of the time, operate according to a seventh sense that directs us not to kill, even when we might profit in some way from doing so? and lesser transgressions, too. Why do we usually feel guilty when we steal or lie or hurt other people? We have already discussed what causes sociopathy, and so it is only fair to address the twin question, what causes conscience? From a certain point of view, this inquiry is not merely parallel. It is actually the better and more baffling question. Since Darwin published The Origin of Species in 1859, much of scientific theorizing has considered that all living things, including human beings, have evolved according to the law of natural selection. According to this law, known more popularly as the law of the jungle, any characteristic that enhances survival and reproduction, and therefore the continuance of its own genetic components, will tend to remain in the population. If a physical trait or behavioral tendency bestows this felicitous survival advantage on individuals for countless generations, in many situations and across habitats, it may, incrementally and in the course of time immemorial, become part of the standard genetic blueprint for the species. According to the law of natural selection, tigers have claws, chameleons change colors, rats avoid open spaces, possums play dead, and apes have big brains, because tigers with claws, camouflaged lizards, secretive rodents, play-acting possums, and very smart primates tend to survive longer and so make more babies than their peers do. In turn, these babies survive better and reproduce more often than their less fortunate playmates, who are not genetically endowed with natural weapons, camouflage techniques, survival-promoting anxiety, theatrical ability, or superior intelligence. But according to this utterly amoral law of the jungle, of what possible use to the individual members of a predatory species, for human beings are technically predators, are the limitations and interruptions of a powerful moral sense. Imagine, for example, a great white shark with a demanding conscience. How long would she live? What, then, can conceivably be the evolutionary origins of human conscience? Let us put this extraordinary question underway. Picture people stranded on a small remote island with limited resources. In the long run, what kind of individual is more likely to survive? An honest, moral person, or some ruthless like Skip, the kind and empathic Jackie Rubenstein, or Doreen Littlefield, Sydney, or the unremittingly self-involved Luke, Hannah, or Hannah's father. If there were a few others on the island for the survivors to make babies with, and given that sociopathy is at least partially genetically determined, over a great many generations, might we not end up with an island populated mainly by people who possessed no conscience? Then, would not this population of sociopaths proceed without a second thought to deplete the island's resources completely and all die? And if, to the contrary, people with conscience were still to be found on the island, where life was fragile and ruthlessness paid off, what in the natural world could possibly have been fostering their moral sense? Precisely on account of this seemingly impossible challenge to evolutionary theory, naturalists, sociobiologists, comparative psychologists, and philosophers have long been interested in the origins of unselfishness in humans and in other animals. Whenever we carefully observe the actions of the so-called higher animals, we see an apparently irreconcilable dichotomy between selfish survivalism and intense social interest. And of course, nowhere is this dichotomy more extreme than in the human species. We compete ferociously, and we teach our children to compete. We finance wars and weapons of mass destruction. And we also fund foundations, social welfare programs, and homeless shelters, and try to teach our children, those very same children, to be kind. Our species has produced both a Napoleon and a Mother Teresa, but according to fundamentalist evolutionary theory, Mother Teresa should never have been born, because neither charity nor a sense of good and evil would seem to have anything at all to do with the law of the jungle. So what is going on here? As David Papineau asked in his New York Times review of Matt Ridley's book, The Origins of Virtue, if nice guys always finished last when our ancestors were scrabbling around for food on the African savanna, why does morality come so naturally to us now? And humans are hardly the only animals who can be unselfish. Thompson's gazelles, Stott, leap up and down conspicuously when they see a predator, decreasing their chances of individual survival, but increasing the chances that the herd will get away. Chimpanzees share their meat, and sometimes even their most valued fruit. According to psychobiologist Franz de Waal, a raven will communicate the precious discovery of a carcass with loud calls to the flock, making itself a standout to wolves. When it comes to surviving, clearly there is a certain conflict of interest between the individual and the herd, community, flock. And arguments concerning the origin of what evolutionary psychologists call altruistic behaviors have generally centered around the unit of selection in evolution. Does natural selection choose only individuals for survival, or can selection perhaps operate at the level of groups, thus favoring the survival of whole populations over others? If survival of the fittest applies only to the individual as the unit of selection, the evolution of unselfishness is almost impossible to explain, for the same reason that Cutthroat Skip, Doreen, Luke, and Hannah's father, as individuals, would indeed be more likely to outlast the rest of us on a desert island. But if the unit of selection is the group as a whole, then a certain amount of altruism can be explained. Quite simply, a group composed of individuals who cooperate and take care of one another is much more likely to survive as a group than a collective of individuals who can only compete with or ignore one another. In terms of survival, the successful group will be the one that is operating to some extent as an entity, rather than the group in which every single individual is looking out for number one, to the exclusion of everyone else. Group selection, and all it implies about our true nature, has been an extremely controversial idea among evolutionists, reflecting the fact that the theory of evolution itself is still evolving. Early theories of group selection assumed the possibility that, in the beginning, there had been cohesive groups of altruistic individuals, mammals that emitted warning behaviors, birds that would signal food to the flock, primates who were generous, and so forth, for group selection to favor in the first place. This poorly explained assumption, aggregations of altruists from the clear blue sky, was irritating to many scholars, who bestowed on it the damning label of weak science. In 1966, George C. Williams of the University of Chicago published a now classic text entitled Adaptation and Natural Selection, in which he argued that although group selection was theoretically possible, it was unlikely to occur in nature. Williams wrote that neither the group nor the individual was the fundamental unit of natural selection, maintaining that the true unit of selection was the gene itself. For creatures that reproduce sexually, as opposed to organisms that generate clones, the gene is the only unit that self-replicates exactly, more or less, through time. Children are not exact copies of their parents, but genes are fairly precise replicas of themselves. And so, Williams insisted, the gene must be the only unit that natural selection can efficiently use. In other words, survival of the fittest meant survival of the fittest genes, or rather the information coded in them, not necessarily the survival of the fittest individual animals or groups. For Williams, individuals and groups were there only to serve as temporary environments for genetic information. And 10 years later, in 1976, in a still popular book called The Selfish Gene, Richard Dawkins extended Williams' gene-centered theory and biologist W. D. Hamilton's notion of kin selection, which paradoxically re-explains the evolution of unselfish behaviors at the level of the individual, by invoking the idea of selfishness at the level of the gene. This is a rather strange notion and deserves some explanation. Kin selection means that pieces of the individual's genetic blueprint, the only biological aspect of the individual that stands a chance of being immortal, so to speak, will fare better if the individual guards not only his own survival and reproduction odds, but also those of other individuals who share some of his genetic makeup. If he behaves generously and protectively toward his blood relatives, their enhanced survival and reproduction rate will increase the numbers of his own genes in future generations, since his relatives and he have many genes in common. Of course, the expression selfish gene is not intended to imply that DNA is a thinking, feeling thing with its own desires. Dawkins uses selfish gene as a metaphor.
He means that the characteristics of a species are determined by genes that cause individuals to think, feel, and behave in ways that maximize the existence of those same genes in the gene pool, regardless of the effects of those thoughts, feelings, and behaviors on the individuals themselves. For example, if my brain allows me to form emotional attachments, and I feel so warmly toward my cousins that I share my fruit with all of them, my individual life may be shortened, but on average, the odds that my genes will continue in the population have actually been multiplied, because my genes are shared in part by each of my cousins. And the genes that I have donated to the gene pool by lengthening the lives of my cousins may well include the genes that cause me to feel emotional attachments. In other words, the genes for emotional attachment are selfish in the sense that they exist to enhance their own proliferation, and they do this without regard to the well-being or even the continued existence of the individual creature. As in the famous quotation by Samuel Butler, "A chicken is an egg's way of making another egg." According to many evolutionists, because we share the greatest percentage of our genetic complement with our parents, our siblings, and our children, kin selection accounts for the fact that we tend to be more selfless toward our parents, siblings, and children than toward more distant relatives and strangers. Furthermore, kin selection explains why we nurture and protect our children, despite the fact that doing so lessens our own energies and our individual survival resources. From this vantage point, conscience is the genetically programmed mechanism that makes sure we do not ignore the extra little packages of our genetic material that just happen to be walking around on feet other than ours. As for our genetically designed sense of conscience toward the aforementioned distant relatives and strangers, gene-centered evolutionists propose that their version of natural selection would have favored genes that resulted in reciprocal altruism, or non-zero-sum, win-win behaviors, such as the division of labor, friend-seeking, cooperation, and the avoidance of conflict. These behaviors would be mediated by emotions such as gratitude, compassion, and conscience, and so emotions such as these would have had an advantage where the natural selection of genes was concerned. But in a revival of the idea of group selection, other evolutionary theorists, among them David Sloan Wilson and Stephen Jay Gould, have implored both the biological and the behavioral sciences to consider that evolution may, in fact, have taken place on more levels than just the gene-centered one. Naturalist Gould re-examines the evidence from paleontology and maintains that natural selection operates on multiple levels, from the gene to the individual to the group, and even, or especially, the species. In addition, he makes the case that forces operating in a much less incremental fashion than natural selection, and far more rapidly than time immemorial, events that include global or near-global catastrophes, have significantly affected the course of evolution, and may do so again. The various levels of natural selection are likely at odds with one another, particularly with respect to altruistic behaviors and emotions such as conscience. At the level of the gene, and also at the level of the group, conscience is adaptive, and natural selection would favor it. But at the level of the individual creature, the absence of conscience may sometimes be even more adaptive for survival. In this way, nature would constantly be fostering conscience in most of us, while at a different level, continually supporting a smaller percentage of individuals who thrive without the neurobiological underpinnings of emotional attachment and conscience. As evolutionist David Sloan Wilson has said, there are compelling intellectual and practical reasons to distinguish between behaviors that succeed by contributing to group-level organization and behaviors that succeed by disrupting group-level organization. That is what the words selfish and unselfish, moral and immoral, are all about in everyday language. What Wilson describes in this way is the same bewildering and all too familiar dichotomy. The majority, who think and feel in terms of minimizing conflict, sharing when necessary, and living out their lives with the people they love, and the minority, who prosper from conflict, and for whom life is no more and no less than a constant competition for dominance. So we find that even on the most reductionalistic biological level, the struggle between good and evil is more ancient than humankind.
However, the contest is likely to reach its conclusion with us, and its ultimate resolution will depend on the ways we meet the towering challenges humankind has brought into the world, among them the problem of sociopathy. In ways we are just beginning to understand, natural selection has favored a certain amount of altruism in the human population, and has helped to shape a human species endowed with the capacity to love and bond together in positive intention by the still small voice of conscience. At least 96% of us are fundamentally thus. What we will end up doing with the species survival problems created by the other 4% is, at present, unknowable. Heinz's dilemma. Turning now from evolutionary psychology to developmental psychology, we come to the interesting question of how conscience develops in human children. Does conscience flower naturally in children's minds as their other mental abilities increase? Or do children acquire and adjust their moral sense as they experience life, from lessons taught by family, society, and culture? Conscience, as an emotion, has not been studied in this way, but we can learn much from what is known about its intellectual partner, moral reasoning. Moral reasoning is the thought process that attends conscience and helps it decide what to do. If we try, we can express our moral reasoning in words, concepts, and principles. Joe was engaged in moral reasoning as he drove along in his Audi, along with his tormented conscience, and tried to figure out whether he should go to an important meeting at work or return home to feed his dog, Reebok. Conscience, as we know, was Joe's intervening sense of obligation based in his emotional attachment to his dog. Moral reasoning was the process by which he determined just what the obligation consisted of and how to accomplish it. Exactly how hungry will the dog be? Could he die of thirst? Which is more important, the meeting or Reebok? What is the right thing to do? Where does it come from, this nearly universal ability to ask moral and ethical questions of ourselves about everything from whether or not to feed the dog to whether or not to launch a nuclear missile? The systematic study of moral reasoning began in the 1930s with Swiss psychologist Jean Piaget. In one of his most influential works, The Moral Judgment of the Child, Piaget analyzed children's perspectives on authority, lying, stealing, and the concept of justice. He began by recording detailed observations of how children at different ages conceived of rules and played games, and of how they interpreted moral dilemmas. Piaget's approach was structural, meaning that he believed human beings developed psychologically and philosophically in a progressive fashion, each cognitive developmental step building on the previous one, and that the course of this development proceeded in the same order for all children. Piaget described two general stages of moral development. The first stage is the morality of constraint, or moral realism, in which children obey rules because rules are regarded as inalterable. At this black-and-white stage of reasoning, young children believe that a particular deed is either absolutely right or absolutely wrong, and that people will inevitably be punished for wrong behavior that is discovered, an expectation Piaget called imminent justice. The second Piagetian stage is the morality of cooperation, or reciprocity. At this stage, children view rules as relative and subject to alteration under certain circumstances, and their concept of justice gives consideration to people's intentions. Older children can decenter their point of view, make it less egocentric, and moral rules are understood as important to the functioning of society rather than only as ways to avoid individual bad outcomes. Continuing in the Piagetian tradition, and influenced also by the work of the American philosopher John Dewey, psychologist and educator Lawrence Kohlberg began his work on moral judgment in the late 1960s at Harvard University's Center for Moral Education. Kohlberg's ambition was to discover whether or not there truly were universal stages of moral development. Kohlberg's theory is based on interviews with boys ages 6 to 16 in the United States, Taiwan, Mexico, Turkey, and the Yucatan. During these interviews, the children listened to 10 stories, each involving a moral dilemma of some kind. The best known of these stories, a little vignette composed nearly 40 years ago, is strikingly evocative of the current controversy surrounding pharmaceutical corporations and the cost of prescription medications. It is Heinz's dilemma, which, in paraphrase, is this.
Heinz's wife is dying from a rare form of cancer. According to the doctors, there is one drug that could save her, a radium compound that a druggist in Heinz's town has recently discovered. The ingredients for the drug are expensive to begin with, and the druggist is charging 10 times what it costs him to make the medicine. The druggist pays $200 for the radium and charges his customers $2,000 for a small dose. Heinz goes to everyone he can think of and asks to borrow money. Still, he ends up with only about $1,000. Heinz explains to the druggist that his wife will die without the drug and asks him to sell the medicine at a cheaper price or to take payment later. But the druggist replies, "No, I discovered the drug and I'm going to make money from it." Heinz becomes desperate. He breaks into the druggist's store and steals the drug for his wife. Should Heinz have done that? Kohlberg was primarily interested not in the children's yes or no answers to should Heinz have done that, but in the reasoning behind their responses, which he recorded. Based on his many interviews, he proposed that children follow a universal course from self-interest to principled behavior that can be described by a 3-level scheme of moral development. The 3 levels of moral development require increasingly complex and abstract thought patterns, each level displacing the previous one as the child matures cognitively. According to Kohlberg's theory of moral development, 7- to 10-year-old children reason on the pre-conventional level, at which they defer to adult authority and obey rules based only on expectations of punishment and reward. Kohlberg considered that the pre-conventional reasoning of young children was essentially pre-moral. The most typical pre-moral response to Heinz's dilemma would be, "No, Heinz shouldn't have done that, because now he'll be punished." Beginning at about age 10, children move to the conventional level of moral reasoning, conventional in the societal sense, when their behavior is guided by the opinions of other peoples and a desire to conform. At this level, obeying authority becomes a value in itself, without reference either to immediate rewards and punishments or to higher principles. Kohlberg believed that by the time a child was 13, most moral questions were answered on the conventional level. The conventional reasoning about Heinz's theft would be, "No, he shouldn't have stolen the drug. Stealing is against the law. Everyone knows that." Sometime during adolescence, according to Kohlberg, a few people develop beyond the conventional level to the 3rd and highest level, which he called post-conventional morality. The 3rd level requires the individual to formulate abstract moral principles and to act on them to satisfy his own conscience, rather than to gain the approval of others. At the post-conventional level, moral reasoning transcends the concrete rules of society, rules that the individual now understands are often in conflict with one another anyway. His reasoning is informed instead by fluid, abstract concepts such as freedom, dignity, justice, and respect for life. Where Heinz is concerned, a person reasoning at the post-conventional level might well insist that human life was more valuable than money, and that the sanctity of life was a moral law that superseded society's rules about stealing. Yes, it's a difficult problem, but it's understandable that Heinz would steal the life-saving drug that the druggist was withholding for reasons of money. Kohlberg believed that most people never completely achieved post-conventional moral reasoning, even in adulthood, because when he interviewed older boys and young men in his studies, he found that fewer than 10% of them offered clear level 3 responses. As a footnote here, I would mention that this view of Kohlberg's, if right, might help to explain the passing strange fact that moral outrage from the public is relatively limited when it comes to the aforementioned wealthy pharmaceutical companies. Perhaps most of us, Americans especially, are inclined to accept the druggist's proprietary claim, "I discovered the drug, and I'm going to make money from it." Honoring ownership above all other features of a situation is a part of conventional moral reasoning, or it is at least among men raised in North America. Enter gender and culture. What factor does Kohlberg's system of moral development leave out, even at its highest level? Answer: Heinz's relationship with his spouse, which is appreciably more personal and perhaps more compelling than even the most evolved understanding of the general sanctity of life. And what, most likely, is the major flaw in Kohlberg's overall research design? It is that when he originally asked his moral questions, he asked them only of boys.
Kohlberg, a brilliant social scientist, somehow managed to overlook half the human race. This oversight was addressed in 1982 in a groundbreaking book by Carol Gilligan entitled In a Different Voice, Psychological Theory and Women's Development. A student of Kohlberg's, Gilligan, too, was interested in advancing a universal stage theory of moral development, but she strongly disagreed with the limited content of the moral levels Kohlberg had proposed. Kohlberg, she said, had produced a model of moral reasoning that was based on an ethic of justice, a preoccupation with the rules, be they concrete or abstract. Gilligan believed that Kohlberg had derived only an ethic of justice because he had interviewed only males, and that if women were interviewed, a very different system of ideals would emerge. She interviewed women who were making momentous decisions in their lives and discovered that these women were thinking about the caring thing to do rather than pondering the rules. Women, decided Gilligan, reasoned morally according to an ethic of care rather than a male ethic of justice. She theorized that this was so because girls identify with their mothers and tend to have experiences within the family that emphasize interpersonal responsiveness. Gilligan argued eloquently that neither vantage point was superior to the other, but that the two ethics simply informed two different voices. Men spoke of attachment to societal and personal rules, and women spoke of attachment to people. Women's moral development, Gilligan said, was based not solely on changes in cognitive capability, but also on maturational changes in the way the self and the social environment were perceived. A woman's post-conventional judgment regarding Heinz's dilemma would refer to the importance of his relationship with his wife, and might assert, as well, that the druggist's claim was immoral because he was allowing someone to die when he could do something to prevent it. Gilligan was persuaded that post-conventional reasoning in women focused on the value of doing no harm to self or others, which is more specific and relational, and in many ways more demanding than a principle such as the general sanctity of life. Thanks to Carol Gilligan, psychologists and educators now understand that moral reasoning has more than one dimension, and that people develop morally in much more complex ways than we first believed. In the last 20 years, newer studies have shown us that both women and men may use both an ethic of care and an ethic of justice in their moral reasoning. These two voices speak in complex choruses, and gender differences are far more intricate than a single, unambiguous line between all women and all men. We now know also that there are probably no universal stages of moral development through which all human beings everywhere pass, even when we divide the human race in half by gender. Cultural relativism exists even in the moral domain. And if moral reasoning has two dimensions, one of justice and one of care, then why not three dimensions, or hundreds, or more? Why not as many perspectives as there are human situations, values, and ways to raise children? One illustration of the significance of context and culture in moral judgment is the work of Joan Miller and David Bersoff of Yale University. Miller and Bersoff have studied American children and adults from New Haven, Connecticut, as compared with Hindu children and adults from Mysore City in southern India. They point out that American culture encourages highly individualistic views of the self, autonomy, and personal achievement for both boys and girls, versus Hindu-Indian culture, which teaches an interdependent concept of the self to both sexes, the value of permanent ties to other people, and of subordinating one's personal ambitions to the goals of the group. In their studies of moral development, Miller and Bersoff found that Hindu Indians tend to regard interpersonal responsibilities as socially enforceable moral duties, as opposed to the American view of such tasks as occasions for personal decision-making. For example, whether or not to take care of one's sister who has Down syndrome after one's parents can no longer do so would be viewed by an American as a choice, a decision that had moral implications, but a choice nonetheless. The same situation would be seen by a Hindu Indian as a non-negotiable moral imperative, dharma, along with an expectation that the family would compel the fulfillment of this duty if necessary. Furthermore, Indians believe that interpersonal duty is a natural part of what most individuals are inclined to do anyway, as opposed to Americans, who believe that social expectations and personal wishes are almost always opposed to each other, and that one must somehow strike a balance between them. Such differences in belief and early instruction are large, and they tend to create substantial cross-cultural diversity in moral reasoning. Miller and Bersoff report that Hindu Indians, both men and women, develop according to a duty-based perspective, a dimension of moral judgment that is different from both the ethic of justice and the ethic of care. They conclude, "We interpret our results as implying that qualitatively distinct types of interpersonal moral codes develop in American and Hindu Indian cultures, reflecting the contrasting cultural views of the self emphasized in each setting." And yet, despite the many and diverse processes of moral judgment spun off by our various human cultures, in the final analysis, there is something more to the heart of the matter, something deeper and much less variable. This fixed psychological element is our sense of an irreconcilable contest between moral forces, an overall perception of good and evil as a duality in human life, which seem to be completely and astonishingly universal, astonishing to social scientists at least. Good versus evil is the ageless, culture-free human plot, and the undertones of a seemingly universal moral struggle are readily recognized by both genders in all cultures. I would expect a woman from the south of India to possess this fundamental sense of a divided moral realm, and she would expect the same of me. For example, where poor desperate Hines is concerned, independent of a judgment regarding how he should resolve his dilemma, what he should or should not do, there will be a general, if unspoken, agreement across cultures that Hines, with his commitment to someone he loves, has the higher moral ground as the story begins, and that the selfish druggist is behaving badly. There is no global consistency in the intellectual process of moral reasoning itself in how we think through moral dilemmas and decide what specifically to do. But is there a unity in our emotional reaction to the moral struggle between good and evil, a near-universal seventh sense that we can be relied on to ignore all of our differences and borders? And if so, how does it feel? The universal bond. As I begin to write the final section of this chapter on the origins of conscience, it is the morning of September 11, 2003. I usually like quiet while I work, but this morning I've turned on a television in the other room so that I can hear the voices of the children at the site of the former World Trade Towers as they read the names, one by one, of the people who perished there. Earlier this morning, I sent my daughter off to school, just as I did on the morning of September 11, 2 years ago. The difference is that 2 years ago, between the time I sent her to school and the time she came home, the whole world had changed. I notice how easily the flood of emotion still comes, though 2 years have gone by since then. Of all the unexpected reactions a person can have during a catastrophe, one of the more surprising ones for me was feeling suddenly and very consciously linked to all the people I had ever known in my life, from childhood on. Everyone who had ever been important to me, even for a little while, anyone for whom I had ever felt affection. In the days after September 11, 2001, I remembered people I had not seen or even thought about for years, or in some cases decades. I saw their faces in my mind with almost unnerving clarity. I had no idea where many of these people were, so long had it been since they were in my life, but I wanted helplessly to pick up the phone and call all of them. I wanted to ask them how they were, my high school writing teacher long ago in North Carolina, a roommate from college, the soft-hearted proprietor of a grocery store where I used to shop in Philadelphia, who would give away food to those who could not afford it, and then enjoin his other customers to secrecy. Were they okay? Those whom I could call, I called. No one even found this strange. We simply checked in with one another. Moral reasoning, the way we think about moral dilemmas, is anything but consistent and universal. It varies with age and with gender. It differs from one culture to the next, and most likely from one region or even one household to the next. For example, what I think about terrorism and what we should do about it will probably be slightly different from what my neighbor thinks, and will almost certainly be different from the beliefs of people who are removed from me by oceans and continents. But in a kind of human miracle, one thing remains constant for nearly all of us, with some notable exceptions, and that is our profound attachment to other human beings.
Emotional attachment is part of most of us, down to the very molecules that design our bodies and our brains, and sometimes we are powerfully reminded of it. Beginning in our genes and spiraling outward to all of our cultures, beliefs, and many religions, it is the shadow of the whisper of the beginning of an understanding that we are all one. And whatever its origins, this is the essence of consciousness.